It's a brazen scheme to eliminate the authority of the U.S. government, submitting our nation to the whims of a new regional superpower. America as we value it will steadily disappear, as will our rights, our Constitution, and our freedoms. Help win the war against the FTAA. Go to stoptheftaa.org and help keep America free. That's stoptheftaa.org.
What in the world is going on? Stay tuned to FirstAmendmentRadio.com to find out first. And on satellite at Galaxy 13, Channel 16, Audio 7.70.
Roll away the dawn. Roll away the dawn and let me see the land of the free. Anything changed down? Sweet liberty, sweet liberty is in our hands. It's part of the plan, or is it a state of mind? Never forget.
You're listening to Jackie Patru and Sweet Liberty. And now, here's your host, Jackie Patru.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us tonight on Sweet Liberty. Today is Monday. It is the 20th of June in the year 2005. And I hope you had a lovely weekend. It looks like maybe our summer weather is coming back. We went down into the 40s a couple nights, and it's been as low as in the 60s. The early 60s, if you would, in the daytime, 62, 64, and it looks like it's warming up again, and that's wonderful. Our spiritual message this evening, I've been saving this for you. I pulled this the other day from my Course in Miracles cards. They're sayings of A Course in Miracles, and this is from the text on page 127. Listen to this. When a mind has only light, it knows only light. Its own radiance shines all around it and extends out into the darkness of other minds, transforming them into majesty. I like that a lot. I want to read that one more time to you. When a mind has only light, it knows only light. Its own radiance shines all around it and extends out into the darkness of other minds, transforming them into majesty. And I'll tell you what we're going to do tonight, folks. Last week on Tuesday and Wednesday, I had started reading to you from the two chapters of Jewish persecution that has been in the process for a long time. And we got through chapter 16, which, as far as I'm concerned, it shows without any doubt who it is that controls Freemasonry, at least today. And that would be those who call themselves Jews, and that would be the Jewish establishment or the elite. And then in chapter 17, we continue just a bit. I actually was quoting from the book titled The Cause of World Unrest. And as I told you, I believe you can get that book from Sons of Liberty. And I don't have their phone number handy to give to you. But what we got into towards the end on Wednesday, and I started rushing, was the American Revolution and their manipulation, if you would, in that war also. And that's what we're going to do tonight. I want to backtrack a little bit, and I've been doing a lot more research, and I'll tell you what. You know, Alan Watts said, I think probably back in 1998, that America had been established solely for the purpose of bringing in the New World Order. And for many, many years, I was a flag-waving American, proud to be an American, and defending the Constitution to the last. And believing that our founders were actually divinely inspired and divinely led. I believed that. And it's a big hurt when we begin to realize that everything that we've ever been taught, everything we thought we knew, everything that has been given us in the history books and et cetera, it's been a big lie, folks. And that has been very tough for me. And I know that for many of you, too, it's been the same kind of a trip. I'm going to ask you to hold on for just a second because I had some more pages I have to pull out of the off the printer, and I will be right back with you. I don't even have a tape in there for music to play, so we're going to have some silence here for just a couple of maybe 30 seconds, but don't go away, okay? You stay here. Okay, that didn't take too long, did it? Where I'm going to start here is in Chapter 17, and I want you to know, too, that this is a first draft, and there is editing that needs to be done. I get to a place, and then it jogs my mind about something else that I think is important to put in, and I'll find the information and put it in, and then I have to read it and edit it and find a better place to put it, or maybe a more appropriate. So you have to I'm going to ask you to just bear with here, and I'm going to get started. What sent me off on this tangent, by the way, was in Carol Valentine's, and you'll read this in chapters 14 and 15 of the book, Jewish Persecution, which is online. Chapters 14 and 15, we got into the Noahide laws, folks. And I was quoting heavily from a report, a very, very, very well-researched report that Carol Valentine did. And there was a quote there about the definition of a Noahide, being a Freemason, and I clipped that one little paragraph out, put it on a fresh page, because I wanted to do some research on it, and that one little paragraph turned into two chapters of the book, is how it happens. But anyway, last week, and if you didn't hear the broadcast last week, you can get them from WFAR, from their audio archives. I think it's $15 for a month, and you can go in and get all the archives. They're archived on sweetliberty.org, but not for at least 10 days. And Darren, having so many irons in the fire, I don't know if he's even got through May yet, getting them up, because it's a time-consuming process. But anyway, you can also order CDs from WFAR, and at the half-hour break, if you're interested in getting them, you listen and take down the number, and you can get for $15 the broadcast for an entire month of Sweet Liberty. So we're not going to backtrack all the way back. Just suffice to say that the evidence from the book that from which I quoted is sufficient, and for my mind, to realize that, first of all, Freemasonry, of course, there's nothing Christian about it. Nothing Christian about it, if you were listening last week. And so we're just going to leave it there. And then I begin after transcribing from a little bit in Chapter 17 from Chapter 4 of the book, The Cause of World Unrest. I'm going to begin where I quit there, and I'm going to pick it up. And what I said is, it appears then that the definition of a Freemason being a Noahide refers to the non-Jew Freemasons who embrace the Old Testament God Jehovah along with the Talmudic / Kabbalistic precepts, building temples and tabernacles in the souls of men and nation. Those are quotes, some of the rituals that we were given that they do at the certain degrees, taking upon themselves the duties of governors of Israel, traveling from Babylon to Jerusalem, and having as its goal to rebuild the temple, etc. Is it any wonder that the seemingly obsessive love for Israel is so blatantly apparent amongst high-placed elected officials and judges, most of them also being high-degree Freemasons? They might, in fact, be considered the front line of that new species made in hell. They call them Hasidic Gentiles, folks. And according to, if you go back into chapters 13 and 14 and 15, you read about it and you see that these creatures mean it. To poo-poo the seriousness of the seven Noahide laws would be a drastic mistake. We at least need to know about it and know what their plans are. And I said, after finishing chapter 12, which you might want to revisit, a question arose. Since the elders of Zion claim responsibility for all revolutions, why would we believe that the American Revolution was not of their hands also? Evidence pointing to that fact is found in various sources, beginning with Jerry Klinger's How the Jews Saved the American Revolution. And this is from the Jewish Magazine Online at jewishmagazine.com. His article begins with a statement allegedly made by Admiral Sir George Rodney, who was commander of the British fleet, February 1781. Rodney is quoted as saying that they, the Jews of St. Eustatius, Caribbean Antilles, cannot too soon be taken care of. They are notorious in the cause of America and France. And this is Jerry Klinger. We're beginning quoting from his article, How the Jews Saved the American Revolution. He says, the colonial American Jewish experience, 1654 to 1770, was characterized by sharp departures from historic European anti-Semitic patterns of isolation, social, economic, physical, legislative, and religious discriminations. The American colonial world was growing, changing, and evolving so rapidly it did not have time to focus on historical Jewish scapegoatism. The demands of the frontier and the expanding new American economic power. Listen to that. The demands of the frontier and the expanding new American economic power needed the best of all of its people. Jews in colonial America struggled and won rights that were inconceivable and non-existent in Europe. Jews struggled for and won the rights to equal economic opportunity, to own land, to go to higher secular education, to serve in the armed militias, to vote, and in some colonies, to become members of the legislative bodies. In some colonies, the struggle was easy, in others it was very hard. The American experience was not an automatic entitlement to toleration and sufferance. Rather, the pre-revolutionary experience was one that permitted the old discriminations to be challenged and eventually to be put aside. Hatred of the Jew and imported anti-Semitism did exist, but it could not flourish in the melting pot of common need and survival. Jews traced their earliest participation in Virginia's life from the 16th century with Sir Walter Raleigh through Jamestown and the Revolution. The first permanent synagogue, listen to this now, we read about this last Wednesday, the first permanent synagogue community, Kehillah HaKadosh, Beth Shalom, was founded in 1789 in Richmond, Virginia. And I restate that, the first permanent synagogue community, Kehillah HaKadosh, as in Knights Kadosh, degree of Freemasonry. Let's review the initiation ceremony into that degree from the last chapter, according to the Master of Ceremonies. Now, this was out of the book Cause of World Unrest, and he's quoting Albert Pike. And this is what the Master of Ceremonies says. This is the 30th degree, the Order of Knights Kadosh. And the first permanent synagogue community in Virginia was Kehillah HaKadosh. It says, this is what the Master of Ceremonies says to the initiates into the 30th degree. The Order of Knights Kadosh has for its mission the avenging of a great crime. Do you fully understand that this degree is not, like much of so-called Masonry, a sham that means nothing and amounts to nothing? That what you are now engaged in is real, will require the performance of duty, will exact sacrifice, will expose you to danger, and that this order means to deal with the affairs of nations and be once more a power in the world. And then Jerry Klinger continues here. He says that, and I've got a page that came out crooked, so I'm going to have to hold it up here. The Jews tended to settle wherever doors were open, most frequently in the urban environments, but also in rural and frontier areas. Jews did not come seeking freedom of religion as much as freedom of opportunity. Traditional Judaism weakened. Listen to this. Traditional Judaism weakened in the face of American freedom of choice, only to be reborn later with an American voice. Judaism was reborn with an American voice. The American Revolution, 1776 to 1783, did not start out intentionally as a revolution. Well, then our evidence points that that's a lie he just told folks. It was very intentional. The colonial American world was an evolving, growing English world that demanded fair representation from the British Parliament. The British government saw the Americas as a source of money, power, and natural resources to be delivered and ruled unquestioningly by the mother country. The British government failed to realize that the colonials saw themselves as British Americans with the right to a voice in their affairs, to influence their laws, their economy, their frontiers, and their taxation. The Revolutionary War was to be the longest war in American history prior to Vietnam. It was fought over a 1,500-mile front on the developed farmlands of 13 colonies on the sea and on the frontier. Now listen to this. You can see how they begin to stir up the trouble. And their hand is never seen involved in this type of a thing. October 25th, 1765, a group of Philadelphia merchants gathered in the State House to sign the non-importation agreement to fight the hated stamp tax of the British government. The first man to step forward to sign his name was the president of Mikvah Israel Congregation, Philadelphia's only synagogue. Matthias Busch was the first one to step forward to sign his name. As the tensions between Britain and the American colonies increased and finally erupted into war, the American colonial population was split almost into thirds. One-third supported the war, one-third was neutral, and one-third was pro-British. The small Jewish population of America was also divided. The choice, though, was very heavily and disproportionately in favor and support of the American Revolution. Not only did the Jews pledge their fortunes and sacred honor for America, but their very lives. In Philadelphia, July 4th, 1776, listen closely to this one, folks. The Declaration of Independence was written. A copy was sent to Amsterdam via the small Dutch Caribbean island of St. Eustatius. The declaration was intercepted by the British at sea. An accompanying letter with the Declaration of Independence was also intercepted and sent to London as being a secret code about the document that needed to be deciphered. The letter was written in Yiddish. And quoting there for a moment, I said we might ask here why a copy of the Declaration of Independence was being sent to Amsterdam in the first place, via the Jews at St. Eustatius. It is likely that the plans for the American Revolution were worked out from that quarter. We're not privy to the content of the letter that accompanied the document, just the fact that it was written in Yiddish. Maybe it said something like, we now have an entire nation of sacrificial lambs for Jehovah Jove, our Lord God. That's my facetiousness, folks. This next recalls Reuben Fink's assertion. Reuben Fink was a gentleman that we quoted from in Chapter 12 of this book, Jewish Persecution, regarding the Jews' early influence in the colonies themselves. And that chapter alone, as I was writing it, was blowing me away. And the more we read, the more we research, and we find it in the older books, don't we? The book I'm referring to was written in 1941. Happened to be one that Lily found for, maybe a quarter or $1.25 or something at some place. And it turned out to be a gem. And Fink was, Reuben Fink had written the book about Israel and America. And I said this next recalls Reuben Fink's assertion that some of the Jewish traders of Newport and Philadelphia were among the largest ship owners in America. Well, that doesn't surprise us, does it? Because the true, if you would, builders of America, not builders, but those who gave, literally gave their lives, all of their strength and energy in clearing the land and settling it, they weren't Jews for sure, because the Jews became the merchants and the shipbuilders and the bankers for the colonies. Anyway, this is continuing with Jerry Klinger. He said, the war was not going well at first for the young American army. Though facing hard times and even defeat, Jews stood and fought along with their neighbors. Joseph Simon, from his frontier forge at Lancaster, Pennsylvania, supplied the army with the famous Henry White rifles. Jewish trading merchants, peaceful before the war, outfitted their ships to become privateers and ravaged the British at sea. In the area of finance, the young American government might have foundered too, except for the financial genius and personal financial risk and support taken on by Chaim Salomon. Salomon was to die bankrupted by his total support of the American cause. Though small in numbers, the Jews chose to cast their fate with America. And then I said, no, the Jews cast their fate with revolution. The story about Solomon dying bankrupt is questionable and highly unlikely, as we shall see that, among other things, he was a Rothschild agent. And when we take a clear look at the past, beneath the lies into which we've all been born. America did not win the Revolutionary War any more than Great Britain lost it, and more on that later. And then Klinger, the writer of this article, says, but how did the Jews save the American Revolution? As late as 1781, the war had not been won by the Americans, nor was it lost by the British. Arms were being funneled into the colonies by arms merchants running the British blockade, primarily from the tiny free trading island of Dutch St. Eustatius. Jewish merchants and armed traders were a major presence on the island. In 1781, the British realized they had to cut off the open door of arms shipments to the rebels through St. Eustatius. Admiral Sir George Rodney was sent to capture the island. His goal was to destroy the supplies and destroy the island's commercial and merchant class so they couldn't provide any more aid to the rebels. Early in 1781, the lightly defended island felt the heavy presence of the main British battle fleet. While Rodney was engaged in St. Eustatius, Lord Cornwallis and his army of British regulars were forced out of the Carolinas and retreated to the small port of Yorktown, Virginia, on the James Peninsula. He needed to await critical reprovisioning and fresh reinforcements being brought by the British fleet. The weakened British fleet, with Cornwallis' reinforcement, was intercepted at sea by the French fleet under Admiral de Grasse, probably, and soundly defeated. De Grasse took up positions at the mouth of the Chesapeake Bay, blockading Yorktown from the sea. But how did the Jews save the American Revolution? If the Jews had not helped turn St. Eustatius into a major arms center for the Revolution, and if Admiral Rodney had not spent so much time destroying St. Eustatius, and particularly the Jews, the war might have ended differently. There is little doubt that Admiral Rodney's anti-Semitism helped squander his time and played a role in delaying and weakening the British fleet. Ironically, it was the Jews of St. Eustatius who helped win the American Revolution. Now, notice how the word anti-Semitism, they go over there to get rid of the arms dealers, and because the arms dealers happen to be Jews, they're anti-Semitic. Do you see how they use that word, folks? Didn't have anything to do with that they were supplying arms to the American, quote, rebels, did it? Now we're going to take a short side trip here to clear up some more lies we've been taught in history. When Cornwallis surrendered to Washington on October 19, 1781, he surrendered the battle, not the war. Under the Articles of Capitulation, and I've been reading a lot of this stuff, folks. I mean, I've read the documents themselves. You can get them from I think it's called the Avalon Project at Yale University. But the documents are available. And they call this the Articles of Capitulation. When Cornwallis surrendered to Washington on October 19, 1781, he surrendered the battle, not the war. Under the Articles of Capitulation, the common British soldiers were held in forts under conditions that they were fed the same as American troops. And the officers, one for every 50 soldiers, lived nearby to see to their good treatment, while the officers themselves lived in fine quarters in society, being served like royalty. The injured were hospitalized and treated, all at the cost of Americans, as usual. The war had not been formally ended, and in fact it was sometime in March 1782. Now, Cornwallis surrendered that battle in October of 81, and sometime in March of 1782, the House of Commons finally settled on a resolution in Britain to advise the king that the fighting war should end. And, of course, the fighting war was ended but the war is continuing to this day undercover. We're going to take a short break here. Get your pen in hand, please. And let me remind you, folks, that the broadcast you're listening to is brought to you solely by you, our listeners, by you who are supporting it. And for those of you who aren't, you're along for a free ride. And maybe you would like to become part of it if you feel that the information that you get from this broadcast is relevant and worth listening to, which obviously you are. We'll be right back.
Years ahead of the dominant media, find out first on FirstAmendmentRadio.com, on satellite, Galaxy 13, Channel 16, Audio 7.70.
Roll away the dawn.
You have been listening to Jackie Petrou's Sweet Liberty program on the First Amendment Radio Network. This broadcast is also archived and audio streamed on the Internet at FirstAmendmentRadio.com. Sweet Liberty is a fully listener-sponsored program. Your donations to support these broadcasts are a necessity. Send your check or blank money order to Jackie Petrou, P.O. Box 190, Millerton, P.A. 16936. Again, send your check or blank money order to Jackie Petrou, P.O. Box 190, Millerton, P.A. 16936. Be sure to visit the sweetliberty.org website. Thank you for your continued support. And stay tuned to FirstAmendmentRadio.com.
You know, it looks to me like I actually could have written a chapter on the American Revolution and the, or not, the, yeah, the revolution itself and the implications, what it was all about, and the what it laid down, the base that it laid down for the bankers, folks. And maybe that's what's going to happen with this. Maybe that's how come I haven't finished it. I literally have spent the last 4 days doing research, reading, and when you get a look at it, an overall look at it like that, the statement that Allen made back in 1998, that the U.S. was founded solely to bring the New World Order into completion, I don't have a doubt in my mind. I didn't doubt him then, but I didn't know then what I know now. So anyway, where we left off here just before the break, taking our side trip here on the revolution itself, not about how the Jews saved it. But anyway, the war had not been formally ended, as I said. I want you to remember that Cornwallis had conceded, if you would, the battle there at Yorktown in October of 1781. But nothing changed. The fighting quit, but nothing changed, folks. And I saw a painting, a picture of a painting that was made during the Revolutionary War when Cornwallis and George Washington and a couple of other of their high-up officers were sitting and having tea at a table. This was during this so-called war. But anyway, it was not until March, sometime in March 1782, that the House of Commons finally settled on a resolution to advise the king that the fighting war should end. And there's from a book titled The History of the American Revolution, Volume 2, we're on page 617 and to 19. I'm just going to read you a short excerpt here. It says, December 12, 1781, it was moved in the House of Commons that a resolution should be adopted declaring it to be their opinion, quote, that all further attempts to reduce the Americans to obedience by force would be ineffectual and injurious to the true interests of Great Britain. It didn't say any further attempts to reduce the Americans to obedience. Now, hear that, folks. all further attempts to reduce the Americans to obedience by force would be ineffectual and injurious to the true interests of Great Britain. Well, that resolution failed in December, and after a lot of debate and time passed, the final resolution passed sometime. I didn't get a date on that resolution, but it was in March, and this was their final resolution. It said, the House would consider as enemies to His Majesty and the country all those who should advise or by any means attempt the further prosecution of offensive war on the continent of North America for the purpose of reducing the colonies to obedience by force. And the historian who wrote this book said, the motion, after a feeble opposition, was carried without a division. The resolution and the preceding address, to which it had relevance, may be considered as the closing scene of the American War. All right. In other words, the good old boys got together and just decided to stop the fighting. You see, they had other ways to control their subjects, their slaves in America, via the Rothschild banking cartel. It's interesting to note, too, that the actual Treaty of Peace was not finalized until 1783. Under this treaty, the king, his heirs, subjects, etc., were allowed to keep in perpetuity any property they owned in America without having to become American citizens. As well, the king and his heirs and successors, this was under a trust, folks, was to retain mineral rights. One-third of all the gold, silver, and copper mined was to be given to the king. And in this treaty, by the way, it's called the Treaty of Paris, 1783. The king actually granted fishing rights to the Americans, even designating where the fishermen could clean and dry their fish. Now, who does it sound like won this war? Does the loser usually lay out the dictates of a treaty? And does it take 2 years for a peace treaty to be signed after a war is over? Think about this. And then there was another very controversial treaty was signed on November 19, 1794. It's called Jay's Treaty, named after U.S. Supreme Court Justice John Jay, allegedly attempting to, quote, clear up some of the lingering problems of American separation from Great Britain, end quote. Namely, the British were causing problems in and around the territory of the U.S., had not attended to all of the war reparations, such as compensation for large-scale theft of slaves that was agreed to in the 1783 treaty. This is 9 years later. They also continued to occupy Western military posts and to pursue fur trading in the Great Lakes region as if it were their own. Further, they interfered with shipping traffic in the Caribbean, searching American ships for contraband, and impressing American seamen into service to the crown. Does that sound like who won the war, folks? The British agreed to just two items: a removal from the Western posts, and even then at their very own conditional convenience, and they agreed to allow small American ships to trade in the West Indies. The Royal Navy would continue to decide American sovereignty with regard to shipping on a case-by-case basis. Criticism of the federal administration was already raging, and most people saw this treaty as a terrible compromise to American interests. Listen to this. John Jay was burned in effigy by mobs of outraged Americans in numerous rural areas. Hamilton, he's the king's man, was stoned in New York City when he defended the treaty at a mass meeting. Though the treaty was ratified by a narrow margin in the Senate, the House later tried to block it by refusing to fund it. Washington, through careful political maneuvering, managed to quell the motion and give the treaty the force of law. That's George Washington, our hero, the cannot-tell-a-lie guy. And here's another account regarding that treaty. Remember, it was 9 years later, and the British still had British troops. They were still maintaining troops in this, on this land. Here's another account. All other outstanding issues, the Canadian Maine boundary, compensation for pre-revolutionary debts, and British seizures of American ships were to be resolved according to this treaty by arbitration. Jay even conceded that the British could seize U.S. goods bound for France if they paid for them, and could confiscate without payment French goods on American ships. The treaty was immensely unpopular. Sir John Jay became one of the most hated Americans, and this is in quotes, damned and double damned for caving into the British. And that's end quoting. This was 9 years after the alleged victory by American patriots who had won the War of Independence. And there's one more telling quote that should appear here in case our listeners, our reader, has a lingering impression that Americans are freemen. The Paris Peace Treaty, the Paris Treaty, which was the peace treaty of 1783, begins with the description of the King of England as the, listen, Prince Elector of the United States of America. And this is exactly what it says, word for word, folks. In the name of the most holy and undivided Trinity, it having pleased the divine providence to dispose the hearts of the most serene and potent Prince George III, by the grace of God, King of Great Britain, France, and England, defender of the faith, this is the King. King of Great Britain, France, and England, defender of the faith, Duke of Brunswick and Lunenburg, Arch Treasurer and Prince Elector of the Holy Roman Empire, etc., and of the United States of America. That's how it starts. The peace treaty, Prince Elector of the Holy Roman Empire and of the United States of America. Now, let us discover more about Haim Salomon. They have two spellings for his name, by the way. One is S-O-L-O-M-A-N and one is S-A-L, same guy. His partnership with Jew William Morris, the creation of the First Bank of America, and the loans made to the New World via Salomon's associations with the Rothschilds of England, and it was not England, it was France. I need to make that correction. We'll see once again that they foment war, revolution, they fund both sides, and become immensely more wealthy in the process. This first is from the Jewish World Review. Haim Salomon, the rest of the story. This is by Michael Feldberg. In the pantheon of American Jewish heroes, Haim Salomon, he didn't live real long, 1740 to 1785, has attained legendary status. His life was brief and tumultuous, but his impact on the American imagination was great. The U.S. Postal Service issued a stamp hailing Salomon as a, quote, financial hero of the American Revolution. A monument to Salomon, George Washington, and Robert Morris, another Jew, by the way, folks, graces East Wacker Drive in Chicago. And Beverly Hills, California, is home to an organization called the American Jewish Patriots and Friends of Haim Salomon. Born in Lissa, Poland, in 1740, Salomon spent several years of moving around Western Europe and England, developing fluency in several languages that served him well for the remainder of his life. Reaching New York City in 1772, Salomon swiftly established himself as a successful merchant and dealer in foreign securities. This is a guy that saved the American Revolution, actually was responsible for the majority of the funding of the American Revolution, folks. Striking up an acquaintance with Alexander McDougall, leader of New York Sons of Liberty, Salomon became active in the Patriot cause. When war broke out in 1776, Salomon got a contract to supply American troops in central New York. In 1777, he married Rachel Franks, whose brother Isaac was a lieutenant colonel on George Washington's staff. Their ketubah resides in the American Jewish Historical Society. I don't know what a ketubah is. In the wake of a fire that destroyed much of New York City, British occupation forces arrested and imprisoned Salomon. He gained release because the British hoped to use his language skills to communicate with their German mercenaries. Instead, Salomon covertly encouraged the Hessians to desert. Now, we don't know how much of this is true because it's being written by a Jew, but that's what it says. Arrested again in early 1778, Salomon had his property confiscated. A drumhead court-martial sentenced him to hang. Salomon escaped, probably with the help of other Sons of Liberty, and fled penniless to Philadelphia. His property was confiscated, and he fled penniless to Philadelphia. His wife and child joined him soon afterward. So just think about this. He arrived penniless and without property to Philadelphia. Listen to the miraculous recovery Mr. Salomon made. Going back to this article about his biography. In Philadelphia, Salomon resumed his brokerage business. The French minister appointed him paymaster general of the French forces fighting for the American cause. The Dutch and Spanish governments, who do you think was in control of those governments, folks? The French, the Dutch, the Spanish governments, who do you think was in control? The Dutch and Spanish governments also engaged him to sell the securities that supported their loans to the Continental Congress. In 1781, Congress established the Office of Finance to save the U.S. from fiscal ruin. Salomon allied himself with Superintendent of Finance William Morris and became one of the most effective brokers of bills of exchange to meet federal government expenses. If I am not mistaken, William Morris was one of the people that was at the Constitutional Convention. And tomorrow, I'm going to be sharing some information with you about those guys that I thought were divinely inspired. Salomon also personally advanced funds to members of the Continental Congress and other federal officers, charging interest and commissions well below the market rates. James Madison confessed that, quote, "I have for some time been a pensioner on the favor of Haim Salomon, a Jew broker." While supporting the national cause, Salomon also played a prominent role in the Philadelphia and national Jewish community affairs. He served as a member of the Governing Council of Philadelphia's Congregation Mikvah Israel. He was treasurer of Philadelphia's Society for Indigent Travelers, and he participated in the nation's first known rabbinic court of arbitration. He participated in the nation's first known rabbinic court of arbitration. Salomon helped lead the successful fight to repeal the test oath, which banned Jews and other non-Christians from holding public office in Pennsylvania. And then we're taking a side trip here. It's interesting to note that no matter where the Jews live, no matter what the laws of the particular nation, they're allowed to have their own courts. When they were allegedly captives in Babylon, they were allowed to live apart in their own section under their own laws. It makes one wonder who controlled the king of Babylon at that time. I've got to get my papers in order here. My guess would be the priesthood was in control, as it appears to be the controlling hand behind all pharaohs, kings, and today's prime ministers and presidents. Now here's an item, an excerpt from a news item talking about the courts, the Jewish courts. IsraelNationalNews.com. The headline says, oh, this was June 7th. I don't have the date on here. I need to make a note to make the date. It says, Rabbi Aden Ibn Israel Seinholz elected to head the Sanhedrin. As parades filled the streets of Jerusalem Monday, Jerusalem Day, the reestablished Sanhedrin convened in the city to elect a Nasi, N-A-S-S-I, and representatives to lead it. The current format of the Sanhedrin is an attempt to renew the historic Sanhedrin, Judaism's highest legal religious tribunal, during Holy Temple times. The 71-man assembly convened in one of the Holy Temple chambers and existed from several decades before the Common Era, that would be B.C., until roughly 425 C.E., after the Common Era. We know that is A.D., folks. The renewed body was launched last year in Tiberias, now convenes in Jerusalem, and is still struggling to gain wide acceptance and legitimacy in the Torah world. Since its launching, in the first place, the Sanhedrin, the ancient Sanhedrin, was 72 men. And they're saying that it was a 71-man assembly. So there's something going on here. Since its launching last October, this article says, from IsraelNationalNews.com, Tiberias, where it last convened 1,600 years ago, it has met in Jerusalem on a monthly basis now. In addition, various committees have met more often to discuss issues such as determining the exact location of the Holy Temple, the establishment of courts, listen, the establishment of courts of non-Jews who accept the seven laws of Noah, and Prime Minister Ariel Sharon's plan to upgrade the Jewish communities of Gaza and Northern Samaria, and many more. And then I'm skipping down quite a few paragraphs. They go on to talk about all the rabbis who are serving on this Nasi. We'll start here. Newsweek magazine said of the Nasi elect, Jewish lore is filled, this is quoting Newsweek magazine, Jewish lore is filled with tales of formidable rabbis. Probably none living today can compare in genius and influence to Aden Seinholz, whose extraordinary gifts as scholar, teacher, scientist, writer, mystic, and social critic have attracted disciples from all factions of Israeli society. That's end quoting. Now listen, the rest of this article, that last paragraph I'm going to read to you, it says, listen closely, folks, and then go back and read sections 14 and 15 of the book Jewish Persecution, talking about the Noahide laws. It says, also present at the meeting on Monday, though not seated in the 71-seat semicircular row of chairs, was famed archaeologist Dr. Wendell Jones. Boy, Jones, boy, that didn't sound like a Jewish name to me, did it, you? He is working with the Sanhedrin to establish a system of courts for non-Jews adhering to the seven laws of Noah, which the Torah obligates all of humanity to follow. One of those laws is to establish courts of justice. Listen here. A high court has been established by the Sanhedrin for such purposes, and a subsidiary of that court will soon be established in the United States as well. Boy, folks, I don't know how that grabs you. We're just about out of time here. I'll tell you what we will do, because I believe that this is important. I've got more here on Chaim Soloman, and I've got some, as I said, information that I want to share with you tomorrow night. Charles Beard's book on the economic interpretation of the Constitution, very telling. And if you think that any of those guys, those 54 men, were in that constitutional convention back in 1787 because of divine providence, well, then you would be like I was, and we were sadly mistaken. I'm going to stop here, though, and then just pick it up tomorrow night. We've got about 3 or 4 minutes left. If any one of you would like to call, you're very welcome to. The call-in number is 570-537-3025. Let me do this. Let me give you Alan's address again. His book is done. And for those of you who've already ordered the book, as far as I know, they're already on their way to you, folks. That's the third book. And I'm going to give you Alan's address. If you have not ordered the books that he has written, you might want to do so. It is Alan Watt, A-L-A-N-W-A-T-T. If you have your pen in your hand, you should get it. Site, S-I-T-E, 41. The address has to be perfect or it won't make it there. Alan Watt, Site 41, Box 4, Astaire, like Fred Astaire, it has an E on the end of it, E-S-T-A-I-R-E, Ontario. The postal code is P as in Paul, E, or P as in Peter, E, 3, oh, excuse me, let me start over here. P as in Peter, 3. It's a P3, E as in Elizabeth, 4, N as in Nancy, 1, P3, E4, N1. And then be sure to write Canada on it. Make sure your full name, first and last, is on the envelope, or they won't send it through as a return address, proper return address. And do remember that it has to be either cash or an international postal money order. You can get those at your post office. This is Alan's third book. For you, those of you who are new listeners, if you want to kind of get caught up on so much of what he has taught us of ancient history, you would want to start with book one. And there are 3 of them now. Each of them are $25. And that includes the shipping and the handling. Well, not the handling. The shipping, the postage. So once again, it's Alan Watt, Site 41, Box 4, Astaire, Ontario. Postal code P3E4N1, Canada. And we'll see you back tomorrow night. We're going to do some more on this Revolutionary War, and then we're going to talk some about the Constitutional Convention and see what you think. After you hear this information, a background, a bio on the guys who were at the convention, folks. Thank you for being here tonight. Have a lovely evening, what's left of it. Sweet dreams tonight. And God bless you all. Thanks for being here. Good night.
Render unto Caesar that which is Caesar's. I want you to know that a corporation is